It gives me great pleasure to introduce Jamie Anderson, who will be talking about sound system measurements and optimization. Something you've never talked about before, I would imagine. Jamie is half of Rational Acoustics, probably the irrational part, but that part, and has been... Have you been involved with Smart almost from the start?
I joined... in 99, because Smart started off in 95.
Okay.
So in 99, EAW bought it. And then the first version I was the principal behind
just
was Smart Life.
Yes. That's fine.
Oh, I'll leave you to it.
Anyway, I kind of titled the focus of this thing, because I get involved with this a lot, is the work of trying to create or get actionable data that people can go and make decisions on in situ, get stuff that you can make decisions on quickly as well, because as a lot of us know, time... Oh, good. Could I get a key light up here too? Just a little bit of no color. No, all right. make it pop. This is kind of where I come from. I started off as a electrical engineering student, but then went to drama school for my master's. It was there that I gave over the dark side. Before that, I was optical physics, and I thought I was going to be a lighting guy. I got interested in sound. And so for my master's thesis, I had seen a whole bunch of people using analyzers. In fact, I went in and I did my, as a sound designer, I remember going into a space and playing my lovely tapes that I had created. Tapes, yeah. That I'd spliced together, and we're playing back in the space, and it sounded nothing in the space like it did in the studio. And in fact, when I panned it from left to right, and I do that for you, left, right, right, it didn't sound anything on the left like it did on the right. And so I remember seeing these guys setting up rock and roll shows using an RTA, pink noise, right, and putting a microphone out. And so I said, well, there it is. There's my solution. I borrowed one. It was a Rain... REGs, what, I forget what it is. It had a built-in third octave EQ and a third octave analyzer, and you just played this little game, and you got all the lights going green across the top, and Bob's your uncle. And so that was great. I found the solution to all my audio problems, except that I started to notice that we go from one space to the next space to the next space, and even though it got me kind of tonally matched, it didn't sound the same in small spaces compared to large spaces, and it did nothing for getting rid of those hums and buzzes and crackles and pops and stuff like that. Anyway, so I did my master's thesis. I started studying, it was equalization for sound system optimization, I think was the end name of it, but I ran into a bunch of people. One of the readers of my thesis was Bob, so that was where the connection was. And so it ended up being a very large job application, because in 92, a year after I graduated, 91 was when SIM2 came out?
Yes.
Okay. So I started working at Meyer Sound, and there I was the SIM and technical support manager, but of course there was the director of SIM and technical support, and I was the manager of the rest of the department, which was me. So I spent a big chunk of time. Now, one of the things I want to point out about that, and then I'll get cruising through all this, is that, did all you guys hear Bob yesterday go through this? But one of the things that you kind of noticed about what they had to do to get this dual-channel FFT measurement going, it was a pretty cumbersome process. It was pretty laborious. It was a process that took a bit of time. It certainly wasn't a nimble, either the equipment nor the process was particularly nimble. And it was something that took a lot of building up of trust. And the thing was that Bob had already established relationships with a lot of the theater market, the people that were paying for and using the SIM services, which actually meant that I ended up doing a lot of work trying to take this measurement to the trunk slammer. The people that are out there doing rock and roll shows, set it up the day, go away, a lot of live audio, guys that really didn't want to see that analyzer near them or didn't understand what it was. And so I started to be exposed to an element that kind of formed my thought process and system alignment along the way. the thing is that at the time, let me ask you this. How many of you guys have an analyzer? How many of you guys, are you guys familiar with SMART? How many people are familiar with SMART? How many own SMART? Get this answer. How many have Systune? Wave Capture? Monkey Forest? No. Melissa? No, what's amazing is the number of hands that are going up. Oh, Sim? Now, the thing is that when I got into this, the analyzers were, you know, $20,000-$30,000 at a pop, and not to mention microphones, and microphones were, you know, if you had eight microphones, you'd end up with, what, $12,000 worth of microphones you're carrying around. So the get-in was pretty steep. What happened about midway through being at Meyer is the guy Sam Berkow came out with the SMART program. One of the things that happened somewhere in that time was that the processors and laptops got strong enough to run the FFTs so that you could actually recreate these analyzers on a laptop. That was amazing because that's the infinite number of monkeys point. You know what the infinite number of monkeys? Infinite number of monkeys on infinite number of typewriters will eventually create the works of William Shakespeare, which is wrong. If you study limit theory, L'Hospital says that, no way. But an infinite number of rednecks with infinite number of shotguns will create the works of William Shakespeare in Braille on stop signs. We know that that's true. We want to warm up here. But the infinite number of monkeys was the fact that all of a sudden this started to be put in the hands of a bunch of sound engineers, and not rigorously trained sound engineers, not guys with degrees and making stuff work and happen on the road. I got a question here. This is just talking about all the different uses of it. And the more important thing, do you know your job? Because your analyzer doesn't know your job. It's nice if your analyzer is built, kind of purpose-built for your job, but it still can't make any good decisions. But I'm going a little bit non-linear in my presentation, too. I'm trying to do some compacting. But like, it's as long as you got, it turns out. And sometimes, as long as you got may actually be compacted down to 5 minutes or something like that, or at least the amount of time you have to turn on an analyzer and make some measurements, but you're still beholden to a downbeat or somebody's going to walk out on stage and start talking. It's very rare that you're able to hold a show for tuning. In fact, you know, a lot of stuff, you develop really good skills at tuning in situ during the show. Anyways, this thing right here, just the rest of my history, I left full-time employee Meyer to tour and be independent. In 99, I went over to EAW, who owned SMART, and that's where I've been with SMART since 99. The first version I had designed, I was a principal behind, was a version called SMART Live, so that's version 4. So I've been with it for 15 years, 16 years. Around about 2008, we hit a point where it was impossible to run a niche software company inside a larger hardware manufacturer that was bought by a larger hardware manufacturer. See, it's the rate I'm talking. A larger hardware manufacturer who was bought by a bunch of bankers from Boca Raton. So there was no chance that the analyzer, the SMART platform, was going to survive. And so in 2008, same year that Dave Gunness left EAW and formed Fulcrum, we left and bought that software division. We formed Rational Acoustics. Now, the whole reason why we did it is because the software is just a squiggly line generator. I mean, it's pretty much meaningless until you know how to use it. It's the knowledge behind it. And so we actively sought out distribution and instructors because it's the knowledge on how to use the tool that really makes it a useful tool. And so we've worked pretty hard at trying to get a lot of instructors out there. We now have 14 or 15 instructors worldwide, and so we're trying to be pretty active about getting the knowledge out there. Okay, so that's a quick view over this, but this is something that there's some stuff that I'm pulling up from the class that I teach, and because I'm trying to go really quickly, because I want to get to some cool data just to show you this, and one of the things is, well, there's a term. The term we have, I'm pretty sure Bob coined this, but it nails it on the head, and that is the term's called measurebation. Have you heard that term before? That's the act of taking a microphone and placing it in the middle of the room or wherever, and then going to your Equalizer 2000 and just dropping in all these filters and knocking a line flat. And that's really, if you want a flat line, you can go to Photoshop if you want a flat line. I think the entire intent of what we're trying to do is we're trying to be like doctors. I mean, I like to say we're being like doctors, so my mom's proud of me, that my son, the doctor. But the thing is that what we're trying to do is figure out what's causing the problem and solve the problem. The closer we get to the source of the problem, the more, you know, the more solid, the more effective your solution's going to be. So we, as system engineers, and I'm looking at this job from the system engineer's point, is I'm going to take this stuff and try to make what you need to happen. Here's the layout here. Is we start off with our goal, our concept. So this, all sound systems are going through this process. Is you start off with what you're trying to create. Now, it could be something as crazy as, say, Beatles Love, which had a bazillion speakers out there and panning sources through the whole space. It could be somebody walking up to a microphone and saying, number 47, your order's ready, right? But you have an idea of what this thing wants to be as a sound system. And then you have the venue. Where are you going to do this? So where am I going to have this thing happen? Quite often, this and this don't match, which is always fun. There's a term that I've heard a lot, like a gymatorium, things like that. That's always good. But I think that houses of worship sometimes, or political places where they're having rallies, are one of the biggest dichotomies, because you're talking about message is important, intelligibility is absolutely key and important, and yet you're putting people in a space which is fighting you tooth and nail the entire way. And it's treated with surfaces that are not kind, not giving you the type of RT times you need for intelligibility. So the next step along the way is, if you can come in and you can, actually this is going to be interesting, because I ask this in class all the time. I say, how many people get to design the spaces the systems go into? And nobody in their class raises their hand. But some of you criminals are in here right now, right? Now, the thing is that I always tell people, though, that you have to, you know, even if you're involved in a project and you're not an acoustical consultant, you're just a person that, you know, knows that you're going to do sound in this room. And my favorite lie is, we're never going to do amplified sound in here. Okay, but what happens is you have to have somebody come in and say, look, you need to build a place for speakers. The speakers, you need to put a place for the speakers to go, because it's the whole thing is about getting the right system in the right place, right, to achieve the goal. And so if nobody speaks up, you'll end up with like a couple soffit mounts over there for your main system, all right, or it's all going to be ceiling speakers or whatever. And so it's just somebody being able to chime in and say, build the space right. But then you get the system design. Now, this is the cool thing, is there's so many manufacturers, and you guys I've seen a bunch of presentations about, this is one of the best opportunities to solve your problems. There are some fantastic modeling things. What I would like more than anything is, if I was doing a day of show, we're loading in, we put up the system, we turn it on, I'd love to, at the moment that we turned it on, we verified everything came up, I'd like to be done. I'd like to be out in catering by that point, right? And so the thing is that this is your biggest opportunity to solve your problems, or to create your problems that you have to, that you're trying to deal with later on with your alignment. Then equipment verification, this is where that's where the analyzer gets involved. An analyzer is just a tool. It's not a religion. Okay? The thing is that a lot of analyzers incorporate a methodology into them. Like, I know, having spent 15 years working on an interface is about coupling a measurement, because like the dual channel measurement, this is it. Get the signal going, get the signal coming out, compare them. That's the whole thing, right? But it's about building a tool that works in the methodology of how you're working, to work with your workflow. One of the things that I notice in some analyzers is that quite often analyzers are built for function by a person. I'm not going to beat on you, Dave, but Dave, I've seen him build a bunch of in-house analyzers. The thing is, when you build an analyzer for capability, when you're the prime director, You know what all those little buttons do. But when you want usability as a tool, then where anybody can get up there and use it, the environment can get really complicated, and I'll show you that. But one of the things that we used to do is even put the FFT window type, data window type. Who out there on the fly is going to be changing the FFT? I like a Blackman Harris. I like a Parson Welsh. We turn out that's not the interesting thing. And as our systems get more complicated, this is the analyzer. So you want to be able to simplify it so you can control it, read data, and very efficiently pass through that data. So one of the things that I've been learning over the past 15 years in analyzer design is trying to build it as a tool that you can use as you're going, and it's not fighting you mentally, because you've got a lot of things you got to stay on top of. If you got all the time in the world, awesome. That's great. I got to say, I'm not sure if any of you guys remember this. Some of you might. There was the VeriCurves by BSS. They had a remote. VeriCurve remote is my ideal interface, because I could take the VeriCurve remote, hand it to my mom, and she would look at it if she understood what an equalizer was, and she should by now. And you look down there and say, I want to put the filter there, I want to adjust the frequency, I want to adjust the bandwidth, I want to adjust the custom boot and boost and cut. Wow, I'm just stepping all over myself. But that's the type of thing that when you're really starting to work through stuff, that interface efficiency is really key. We do a class, a couple advanced classes per year, people get really disappointed when what I do, I spend a lot of my time, is boot camping people, which is tear down your whole setup, then build it back up, reconfigure, plug it in, verify it, check it, make sure everything's working properly, and then take your measurements, because you can't skip that step. This, like this right here, you skip that step, the verification, at your peril. This is the important thing. And then you get to this. This is what's interesting, is this is the twiddling of the knobs, pretty much. And a lot of people think that that's the system optimization. That's really the icing on the cake. That's making it do what it was designed to do, maybe stretching it a little past maybe what it was designed to do. But this is the icing on the cake. I can put icing on a brick. It's still a brick, right? This is the cake right there. And so that's something that's going to be very important as you're using an analyzer and I'm doing stuff in here. People get caught up in thinking that what they're doing there is necessarily doing some good there, just because they're playing. Sometimes it's just a video game the way they're using the analyzer. Anyway, look, we're as guilty as anybody. I mean, the smart analyzers out there all over the place. If you count pirated copies, you know, we're the most installed in China. I guarantee you that. But the thing is that you see it all the time: people using the analyzer and not knowing what's actually there. They say, I use SMART, and actually what they're using is the RTA, they're using the magnitude response line, and they're using maybe the auto delay locator, and that's it. And they've been using it for years. And so one of the things that I want to point out is that as an analyzer and as a tool, there's a lot of information you're trying to get out of it. And in a lot of cases, you're trying to use the wrong thing for the wrong tool. The thing that why RTAs got the biggest, the bad rap is because an RTA is the measurement that best correlates with your hearing mechanism, right? You're listening to the signal and you see it. If you're a mixer, your monitor mixer or something like that, and you're listening to something, being able to look at an RTA is going to help you identify frequencies. It's a very good relationship to it. But there's so much. There's time information, signal and noise information. There's all sorts of critical information on making systems work that's not there. If your goal here is just, I need speakers in the bushes at Disneyland making small world noises or whatever, then you just want, all you need is the tonality. But if you're looking for intelligibility in here, that timing, that direct reverberant, that's absolutely critical information to have, as you guys are saying all the way through. So, get through this. So when we talk about system alignment, it really comes down to, and what I'm looking at here is from the system engineer's point of view. So I don't get to design the speakers. I'm just taking the equipment that's there and the system design that's there. And so I want to look at what I'm going to cover next is just, okay, we've got a system there. And so what decisions do we have to make in this alignment and setting, in twiddling these knobs in a way? I mean, we have to verify everything's working properly, but then what type of decisions are we making in that alignment point? At the point of twiddle, I would say. So what decisions do we need to make, and how and why do we need to make them? I love this. You're just doing that because it sounds good. And there's two answers to that. Duh and nah, right? Because yes, of course, you're doing it. You're trying to make the system sound appropriate for what you're doing. I mean, in the end, that's the job, right? Somebody is responsible for making sure that it sounds right, right? But in a lot of cases, a lot of the settings on those knobs, in fact, as you get more and more complex systems, again, Bob pointed out pretty well yesterday, if it's just the speaker and this speaker, then you're just doing it, driving off your ears is almost as good a choice as anything. But as soon as you start combining all these systems together and making them work together towards this goal, a lot of the reasons why you're twiddling that knob isn't because it sounds good right here. What often, if you ever put a system into a club, the thing degrades into chaos right away. And what's happening is somebody comes in, they listen to the system, make adjustment. Oh, that sounds better. Yeah, it sounds better right where you're twiddling that knob. That's actually set to make that interaction between those systems down there work. I can't tell you how many times I've been at a festival where they're driving the outfill systems, where they're driving the delays, the front fills and stuff off the matrix out of the console, where you catch a mix engineer turning those knobs. Because if you said to a mix engineer, turn those knobs till it sounds best to you, they're going to turn down the delays, they're going to turn down the side fills, they're going to turn down the front fills, because that just sounds better to them there. Now, I'm not painting mixers as criminals, but mixers' job is to make it sound good, and they're to make it sound good right there. And as a system engineer, the garbage delivery, again, this is where I get all my lines from. But my job is, if it sucks, if the sound sucks, but it sucks the same everywhere, the system's kind of doing its job of communicating stuff over. But why are we making these decisions? Now, I break it down. This is what I teach when somebody is going through and they're in there to do system alignment. For every single element in the system, RELEPT. I just came up with that term just so I can remember it. Response, level, polarity, and timing. So every single element you have to set and make decisions on them. Not setting them, not making decision is a decision. It's making a decision not to care about it. So the response part plays out as just that magnitude response, but also, does it have the coverage? So is it pointed correctly? Does it have the coverage, the power? Does it have the direct reverberant in some cases? But that, the response of it, then level. All right, so if I'm just doing one speaker, you know, I've got the response of the speaker, whatever I carve out the shape to be. His level is whatever you run the fader up and down. But when it comes time to make a decision about that guy right there, I know that this guy's response wants to be the same as this guy's response, and this guy's level wants to be the same as this guy's level, right? And so you start seeing how you make all those decisions. Polarity, they want to have the same polarity. And timing, pretty much the same timing. But if you look at that as a system, say as a crossover, you got a high driver, low driver. So first you got to figure out where they want to cross over, right? You got to figure out the directivity of the speakers, where one wants to hand over to the other, power handling, all that. That's why I recommend that guys in the field don't set crossovers in the field. Nobody does that anymore, not at the professional level, because you got people back home that are doing the right stuff, blowing up the parts to figure out the power handling and all that type of stuff. But you figure out, this is this driver's range, this is this driver's range. Then once you've got their response, you've got to figure out their level. Once you've figured out your level, then you know their crossover point. When you got your crossover point, then you set your polarity and your timing. So all these elements, when you're knitting a system together, you have to derive all those elements. Therefore, your analyzer has to allow you to measure these elements. So where am I for time? 15 till the end? Okay, so we're going to cruise right through this because we're going to skip over all this stuff. I did say, I've added this to the class. I just stuck this into this slide. But what's interesting, I put beware the vampire, is that quite often people will hire you in, they want you to set this, when what to solve your problems, you really need to go upstream and change the system design or the room or that type of stuff. I said it's a joke that I have in class, beware the vampire, because it refers to Bob, actually. You hire him in to do the tuning of your system to twiddle the knobs. But once you let the vampire in, right, first thing they look at is, can we go back over why this stuff is here? Because it's not working. I got a book if you want to read that book. But the whole thing is that I think that you do enough tuning where you're just knocking your head against the wall and you realize the first thing is get the stuff in the right place. If I can do that, then all of this stuff will get easier and easier as we go. So, okay. So we got our tools, EQ, level, timing, polarity. Okay. But how do we make our decisions? Model it, right? Listening is going to have to play a part. It can be deceived pretty easily, but in the end, we're doing these systems for humans, right? I mean, the computers haven't won yet. So somebody has to decide what's the right level. What's interesting is when I'm teaching an alignment and somebody, one of the things is you determine what the system response wants to be. A good starting place is flat, because that's whatever you put in, you get out. But what you figure out pretty quickly with some shows is, it takes a little time, you figure out what the tonal shape of the system is. But once you know that, you can go by analyzer and nail that down every other place you hit, right? It makes the analyzer a really powerful tool, really consistent way, the ability to put microphones out all over the place, but sit here and nail it down. So it allows you to move really quickly. And of course, A plus B equals A. Why are we making our decisions? Well, you know, I figure out what my main system wants to sound like. Once I know that, that's A. So when I add this system in or I add a delay system in, I already know what my target is. I say A plus B equals A. As I go, I combine this stuff, I just get more of the same. So it's just about how we make those decisions. I want to get to some data here. This is just general stuff about solving the problem at the source, right? Just wanted to put this in here. This is like, it could be the artist, the mixer, generally it's the mixer, the array, the wiring, the drive, the hall. This is a speaker design. This is what I just copy a smart to somebody who can tell me where that speaker is. That's a horse made out of speakers. Okay. Every now and then somebody will know that is it's a sculpture in Hong Kong in Kowloon Station. But this is, you know, where's the problem at? That's actually a pretty cool speaker design. All right, so one bad cable turn $1 million system into an AM radio, right? Or can. So the tools in order to use, this is our least effective tool, the EQ. Although it's something that as you have to tune a system, you are required to set that. I mean, that's part of your toolbox, but this is the least effective guy. Now, what I want to do is the solution to this guy is doing that, not boost cut, boost cut, boost cut, boost cut. Hopefully you are all horrified by that. That's a guy, James Bamlin, has hacked a sim machine and is doing it as a racing game. But it's not a video game. The point I'm trying to make right here, what I'm getting to, trying to stampede to, is this idea of actionable data to give you a squiggly line or a set of squiggly lines that you can do something useful with and not something destructive, because we see this all the time. So, come on, smarting a system, that's a stupid, smarting a system, simming a system, teffing a system, sys-tuning a system, that works really well though, I'm sys-tuning. That's crap. Systems are Jamie'd or Bobbed or Ron'd or Carried or whatever. They're not. I don't say I bring a carpenter over and have him Bosch my house, right? The analyzer is a tool for making decisions. So we want to we want our goal is to get measurements that we can make decisions on, and you have to be able to verify you're making a measurement properly. But how can we get the decision up there? How do we get actionable data? Okay. I want to pound through here. We're talking about mic position, but we're getting to what are we trying to determine? It's kind of a bold statement to take a quarter-inch capsule or a half-inch capsule and put that into this three-dimensional space. I mean, and to say I'm going to make a useful determination at that one point in space. But one of the things I've learned is efficiency, especially in live sound, efficiency of work is a thing. Time is money. You only have a certain amount of time. So getting that capsule in the right space speeds up the whole process. The whole decision-making should be, the whole alignment process should be built into your process as a company. So you're fixing stuff as it's going along. You're checking all your equipment. And so by the time you get everything in place, flown up, you've modeled it, you've got everything, you know, set right, you've verified everything's up, all you've got to do is take a quick tonal decisions. Hopefully everything else has been figured out as best as possible. So what are decision-making points? Okay. Measurement microphone, we'll talk about those in a second. I'm gonna say something later on that there's virtually no difference between those microphones the way we use them, and I don't mean that there's no difference between a DPA and a Behringer ECM 8000. I'm just saying the way we use them as a tool, functionally, let me win you on this. But let's talk about our little, I really did over PowerPoint this thing. Okay. So let's get to measuring something that doesn't exist. Because when you get to setting the EQ, that's one of the major tools that one of the major jobs that you're going to employ an analyzer to do when you're in situ is going to be measuring the average response. The reason why I say measuring something that doesn't exist is there's generally no one point in space here that represents the average response of the coverage area of that speaker. One of the things, if you see guys, you see the Celine Dion load-in in there, Frankie can actually do it that fast as they dial that system in. But the thing is that what allows you to move quickly through a system alignment is your ability to know where those microphones want to go. As you use the same array over and over again, you're able to go, you know what? Yeah, that's the right place. And then when the measurement comes up, you'll remember your last measurement and go, yeah, that looks in the ballpark, or something's weird there. And you go back over and see if your microphone's in the same place. But mic cables are the biggest time consumer if you're trying to move at a rapid pace. So our hero goes out, and we place a microphone right in the center. All this data was taken in a theater in Madrid. The sound system, what we're looking at is four boxes of line array. Not going to say who it is, but it rhymes with Lelity. And so there's four boxes on either side. I'm just measuring the four boxes that are on the... Now, there's another eight boxes up top, but this is just for the orchestra level. So that's what we're measuring. So this is center. Call this our primary position. I break out my equalizer. I'm an EQ master. Put in a filter, 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 filter. Boom! I'll flip it upside down so you can see how magnificent I am. Right? This is measurement, though, because there's other seats. So we move our microphone to another valid seat in the coverage pattern of that array. Huh. That inverted doesn't really fit. And there's another. This is not getting good for me. Huh, I'm going to move it back to... My problem was I moved the microphone. That's the problem. All right. So here we take all that data and we just impose it over itself so you can see... Because what we're looking for is the trend, right? And so we take this guy. I'll do an average. Now, you can obviously see the trend. I find that we use this a lot, a mathematical average of the traces. You don't have to divorce yourself from reality, which means that when I make this average right here, I still have these traces. So I can look at them both and see if something's off. You know, I can say, like, I was looking at this and saying, how bad is this blue trace throwing everything off? So that's the difference between the two traces. So not much, right? So when we're looking at this, Trace. Here, okay, I know what your problem is. Is the answer more EQ? Probably not. The little bit of ripple in here that we're seeing, that's caused by reverb. Answer to that problem is an EQ. This guy right here, that the big question was, why is that there? Well, because we actually measured, well, everybody knows that the company that manufactures these boxes doesn't use 160 cycles, and that's what the problem was. But but actually, in the short of it there is that hopefully you went and measured the box in near field to figure out what the box is doing in near field before you introduce it to the room, right? Because the whole alignment process is gathering of information so you can make useful decisions. So that near field measurement, even though it might not be the perfect location, will tell you what's going on with that box. And we verified very quickly that they were in fact putting out 160 cycles. We did something even more scientific. We just went to a graphic EQ and boosted the 160 cycles with pink noise going through the system just to get an idea of what's going on. Sounded good in the listening area. On stage, next to it, 160 cycles was howling. I'll make you guys groan, I guess, because the boxes down low were in a 3 meter by 3 meter by 3 meter by 1.5 meter deep soffit on the side. And so everywhere in the listening area, the hole was showing up. But the solution to that problem is not EQ, right? Okay, so one of the things we talk to people in training is, can you look at a single trace, but squint your eyes and see trend? I get this all the time where I'm doing something and somebody goes, why are you ignoring that? I used to spend a lot of time asking other people that as well. But can you kind of see the trend in that squiggly line? If you can't, then you end up with some savage EQs. So my suggestion would be, well, why not something as simple as that? Because you have to ask yourself, when you're putting in the EQ filters, the things that they really relate to and are probably the good fixes for is loading conditions and buildups and stuff that are low Q events that are showing up. That's what you're trying to figure out, is what's happening everywhere. I want filters that are in general going to help out. And so anyway, that's kind of that thing, presentation. I just have, this was the 24 microphone setup. It was all running on this laptop. We mentioned that the other day. I want to pull up some smart data. So, is it 11:56 right now?
It is.
See? Calibrated now. All right, so I'm going to go really quickly. I want to show you some data. One of the things, though, is that the way that SMART is set up is actually set up to allow you to measure at multiple points at the same time if you want to. So this was the NT29, the speaker that we were measuring. I took it up to Dave's shop, and he made me an anechoic measurement of that speaker. So then I pulled out the green trace. This green trace is the near field measurement. So we took the speaker and we just put it on the front of the stage and did a 1 meter measure. The stage was a little bit higher than this, but it gives me an idea of the trend. Now, the information that we need, we don't just need this guy down here. This is our magnitude trace, but our phase trace. But what's immediately recognizable is the phase trace, even unsmooth, is showing me the exact same information, giving me about the time response of that box, and then I've got the impulse response of the system. But this is just a good starting point. That's what the box is doing up front. And then I'll go throw the microphone back. So here's the microphone position. I move back into the hall. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take this trace, and I'll drag him up a little bit. And you can see that, so this guy is about 30 feet back in the hall. So you can see the same ripple carried out in this measurement area. But you can see that in general you're seeing some build up there. I'm going to go ahead and smooth down the phase. I'll run this phase a bit smooth. And then here's the magnitude response. And what we're seeing is, as we go back in the room, we're seeing that build up, right? Now, I got to ask you, the first thing I got to ask you is about the accuracy of this guy. This is the data I wanted to show you guys, oddly enough. And, you know, one of the questions is, how repeatable is this measurement? I'm going to take this guy back. So this is an Earthworks microphone. This is one of my matched microphones, meaning that they are roughly the same length, I guess. And so here's a measurement in space. And so for this next set of stuff, what I did was I put it right back in the middle of the room. I got the microphone right there, and I then swapped out the microphone, making sure that the capsule was in the exact same space. So I went through five different microphones. I went for everything from, I have a Earthworks S30, an iSemcon S7150, Audix TM1, a Beyer MM1, an Rational Acoustics RTA 420 is just that kick-around mic. It's the same capsule and stuff as the Behringer ECM 8000 or DBX gives you. ACO Pacific 4048, although I think that's not the capsule number, it's the body. So I got a bunch of these guys right here, and I just made sure that I got the capsule back to the same place. What I'm going to do here is I'm just going to go to just the magnitude response only, so we can kind of see this guy. And so there's my Earthworks. Here's my ASEMCON. Here's my Audix TM1. Obviously, there's a sensitivity difference, right? There's my Beyer MM1. These are all microphones that I have owned for at least 4 years. I want to point out, we are not, when we're doing our measurements in the field, we are not in a laboratory. In a laboratory, your mic is probably not going to get run over by a forklift. So the thing that I point out is you've got to be, I mean, situational awareness, but I'd love to have a really expensive microphone. The microphone that's not on this list is the DPA 4007, because it, in fact, during a class, took the Tomahawk into the ground, and it doesn't have that response anymore. But what I want to show you is, so these are all these vastly different microphones, and there's stuff like, they give you a microphone calibration curve for the microphone. These are all omnidirectional microphones. I come down here, and so these are our acoustical probes. So I'll have them, I'll set them all so that they're the same level. There we go. And I would say that those guys pretty much overlay each other. But I tell you what, you don't have to take my word for it or saying that that's pretty accurate. I'm going to go to here. I'm going to open up. So this is these wildly different microphones. Like I said, everything from a $80 microphone, or you can get it for $20 if you buy $1,000, to the ACO Pacific is probably the most expensive one in there. That's about $1,000 for that microphone. But then I'll open up, this is the same mic, and this is the point I want to make. That's the same, that's the, all the Earthworks is what I use for this. And so these were, that pile of data is the same microphone moved within a foot of itself in space, right? And that's the variance over space. And you can see that. That, I mean, this is the variance mic to mic to mic is not even close to the variance spatially. I mean, so we've got to take this with a grain of salt. Oh, but you got to make sure that you point the microphone properly. I mean, that's going to be key, and it is. I mean, I'm all for consistency. Let's see where these guys. This is my mic rotation. Where do you show up? Okay, so. Hide this data. When I'm doing this, I'm thinking, we've got to build in a feature that allows me to do this quicker. Okay, so this is 0 degrees. So this is the guy at 0 degrees. Come here. By the way. Okay. Here's 45. Now this is a free field, Omni mic. Free field Omni mic is set so that when it's pointing at the source, it's flat. And then what happens with in a microphone, an omnidirectional microphone, as you get into the high frequencies, you get this thing, B&K coined the phrase, or made the phrase, it's called congestion, is what they call it. But basically you get this loading, this buildup in the high frequencies. And so the free field omni has a filter in it to make it flat when it's pointed at you. As you turn it to 90 degrees, that buildup goes away. So from 90 degrees on, it's basically an omni microphone. This is a diffuse field omni, and this pressure field is the difference there. Let me get into. So these are a series of traces. Let me smooth this down to get a better idea of what's going on with these guys. And let's normalize this a bit so that you can really see what's going on. So let me get these lined up better for you. There you go. And so that is what's going on. Everything else from 4K on down, that microphone is functionally on. So most of the stuff that you're doing, yes, I'm all for make sure your microphone is pointed right. But for the majority of the stuff that you're working on, how much work are you doing on a live sound system from 8K to 16K? I mean, maybe a lot, but in some systems it's not appropriate. But here, those microphones are generally going to give you the same response. So the deviation that we're dealing with, this is all to say that the deviation we're dealing with is mostly generated by the space. So the I'm at 1204. We're 5 minutes? Okay. Let me give you an idea where this microphone would sit, just because you guys love this stuff. So this is back in the room. This is the impulse response. To point this out, I'm going to go here. This is the spectrogram of this. So this is frequency this way, time this way. But we see that we have an arrival, and then we've got down here, as we get below 800 and stuff, we have a more reverberant energy. Here, up here, it's pretty tight where it's still being controlled by the horn. But down here, this guy is coming out. We've got a discrete reflection over here. But I'm jumping back over here. And so there's a couple things. I've got this guy smoothed down way too much. Now, when I'm looking at this data, and this is the place I'm going to have to leave you guys off, because I'm sorry that I'm doing the same thing everybody else did. But far too many people just sit there and look at that guy, that magnitude trace, and I'm doing my job. This is the whole thing. And people, so it's amazing when people get introduced to what the phase response is, because the phase response is going to dictate how things are going to add up. But this guy right here is also a really important guy, right? And the coherence is just talking about the stability of the measurement. So one, it's your best friend that's going to tell you if you're messing your measurement up, which is good. It's somebody that's watching your back. But the other thing is, it's telling you about the quality of that energy. Now, what I did here, I'm going to end with this, we're taking and we're creating this guy. Now, in SMART, the phase response measurement, the coherence measurement, are all calculated the exact same way. But you have the opportunity, because of a weird thing in our past, is when SMART 1 came out, the magnitude trace was actually calculated as basically what we might call RMS, or we call it polar now, but basically it's averaging the magnitudes. Whereas there's another way to average these, to use the complex vector. When you're averaging the complex vector, imagine you have a vector of 1 at 0, 1 at 180. If you average just the magnitudes, you'd come out with an average of 1. But if you average the full vector, these two guys would cancel each other out. The net effect, how's that for waving your hands around to describe something like that? The net effect is that if you're using that complex average, as we call it, it aggressively averages out the reverberant energy. So this, what we're looking at down here, is the difference between the polar and the complex. In SIM terminology, I learned that as vector and RMS. But what's happening is that you can see that in the green trace, which is the complex averaging, it's suppressing some of this later arriving information. Also know that we're using shorter time constants up top and longer time constants. So that this something becomes reverberant and destructive a lot quicker here than it does down here. Down here, we have a pretty wide window, a big time constant. But you can see here the difference. Remember in the space that we had that energy hanging out, the complex averaged that guy out, right? Now, this is kind of interesting in our history. I got to go through this because I was absolutely, we did SMART Live. I'm not sure if any of you guys remember when that thing came out, a long time. But in SMART Live, I fought for the fact that we absolutely needed this vector averaging to do for the magnitude trace, because until then, SMART had been this this what RMS or polar average. So we made it the default in 4.0, and everybody complained. And I started to realize that the thing about the magnitude trace, I look at this as tonality, timing, and transmission. You're responsible for all of these. The live sound guys and the people who are tuning systems for music, when we switched to the what we were calling vector then, when we switched to that type of calculation, it no longer they were losing their relationship with it because they liked the curve that was actually allowing in more of that reverberant energy. So that's one of the questions when you're creating the analyzer. Yeah, you can come up and force me off the stage because I can go for hours and hours. But the thing is that you got to know what you're asking in when you're doing the tuning, because a lot of guys that are responsible for the tuning of the system are responsible for sort of that tonality of the system. This is going to tell you if you're getting. If you introduce noise, so I'm going to add in some noise here. I add in noise, and you see the noise builds up here, but the coherence is telling me it's interfering with my intelligibility. That's his job, is to tell you about that, the transmission quality. It's him to tell you about tonality and him to tell you about timing. And I'm going to leave you at that. So thank you. You can get us at rationalacoustics.com, and there, we answer your questions there. Thank you.